Are we going to feel like we're, you know, choking? Bethany asked. Suffocating?
No, Brian said. He had gotten up to see if Nick was coming. Now, as Nick reappeared with a very shaken Laurel Stevenson behind him, Brian dropped back into his seat. You'll feel a little giddy, swimmy in the head, then nothing. He glanced at Nick. Until we all wake up.
Right, Nick said cheerily. And who knows? I may still be right here. Bad pennies have a way of turning up, you know, don't they, Brian?
Anything's possible, I guess, Brian said. He pushed the throttle forward slightly. The sky was growing bright again. The Rip lay dead ahead.
Sit down, folks. Nick, right up here beside me. I'm going to show you what to do and when to do it.
1 second, please, Laurel said. She had regained some of her color and self-possession. She stood on tiptoe and planted a kiss on Nick's mouth. Thank you, Nick said gravely. You were going to quit it. You'd made up your mind. And if he won't listen, I'm to remind him of the day you brought the daisies. Have I got it right? He grinned. Letter perfect, my love. Letter perfect. He encircled her with his left arm and kissed her again, long and hard. When he let her go, there was a gentle, thoughtful smile on his mouth. That's the one to go on, he said. Right enough. 3 minutes later, Brian opened the intercom.
I'm starting to decrease pressure now. Check your belts, everyone.
They did so. Albert waited tensely for some sound, the hiss of escaping air, perhaps. But there was only the steady, droning mumble of jet engines. He felt more wide awake than ever. Albert, Bethany said in a small, scared voice, would you hold me, please? Yes, Albert said, if you'll hold me. Behind them, Rudy Warwick was telling his rosary again. Across the aisle, Laurel Stevenson gripped the arms of her seat. She could still feel the warm print of Nick Hopewell's lips on her mouth. She raised her head, looked at the overhead compartment, and began to take deep, slow breaths. She was waiting for the masks to fall, and 90 seconds or so later, they did. Remember about the day in Belfast, too, she thought. Behind the church. An act of atonement, he said. An act. In the middle of that thought, her mind drifted away.
You know what to do?
Brian asked again. He spoke in a dreamy, furry voice.
Ahead of them, the time rip was once more swelling in the cockpit windows, spreading across the sky. It was now lit with dawn, and a fantastic new array of colors coiled, swam, and then streamed away into its queer depths.
I know, Nick said. He was standing beside Brian, and his words were muffled by the oxygen mask he wore. Above the rubber seal, his eyes were calm and clear.
No fear, Brian. All safe as houses. Off to sleep you go.
Sweet dreams and all that. Brian was fading now. He could feel himself going, and yet he hung on, staring at the vast fault in the fabric of reality. It seemed to be swelling toward the cockpit windows, reaching for the plane. It's so beautiful, he thought. God, it's so beautiful. He felt that invisible hand seize the plane and draw it forward again. No turning back this time. Nick, he said. It now took a tremendous effort to speak. He felt as if his mouth was 100 miles away from his brain. He held his hand up. It seemed to stretch away from him at the end of a long taffy arm.
Go to sleep, Nick said, taking his hand. Don't fight it, unless you want to go with me. It won't be long now.
I just wanted to say, thank you. Nick smiled and gave Brian's hand a squeeze.
You're welcome, mate. It's been a flight to remember. Even without the movie and the free mimosas.
Brian looked back into the rip. A river of gorgeous colors flowed into it now. They spiraled, mixed, and seemed to form words before his dazed, wondering eyes. Shooting stars only.
Is that what we are? He asked curiously.
And now his voice came to him from some distant universe. The darkness swallowed him. Nick was alone now. The only person awake on Flight 29 was a man who had once gunned down 3 boys behind a church in Belfast. 3 boys who had been chucking potatoes painted dark gray to look like grenades. Why had they done such a thing? Had it been some mad sort of dare? He had never found out. He was not afraid, but an intense loneliness filled him. The feeling wasn't a new one. This was not the first watch he had stood alone,
with the lives of others in his hands. Ahead of him, the rip neared. He dropped his hand to the rheostat which controlled the cabin pressure.
It's gorgeous, he thought.
It seemed to him that the colors that now blazed out of the rip were the antithesis of everything which they had experienced in the last few hours. He was looking into a crucible of new life and new motion. Why shouldn't it be beautiful? This is the place where life, all life maybe, begins. The place where life is freshly minted every second of every day. The cradle of creation and the wellspring of time. No langoliers allowed beyond this point.
Colors ran across his cheeks and brows in a fountain spray of hues. Jungle green was overthrown by lava orange. Lava orange was replaced by yellow-white tropical sunshine. Sunshine was supplanted by the chilly blue of northern oceans. The roar of the jet engine seemed muted and distant. He looked down and was not surprised to see that Brian Engel's slumped, sleeping form was being consumed by color. His form and features overthrown in an ever-changing kaleidoscope of brightness. He had become a fabulous ghost. Nor was Nick surprised to see that his own hands and arms were as colorless as clay. Brian's not the ghost. I am. The rip loomed. Now the sound of the jets was lost entirely in a new sound. The 767 seemed to be rushing through a wind tunnel filled with feathers. Suddenly, directly ahead of the airliner's nose, a vast nova of light exploded like a heavenly firework. In it, Nick Hopewell saw colors no man had ever imagined. It did not just fill the time rip. It filled his mind, his nerves, his muscles, his very bones in a gigantic, coruscating fire flash.
Oh, my God, so beautiful, he cried.
And as Flight 29 plunged into the rip, he twisted the cabin pressure rheostat back up to full. A split second later, the fillings from Nick's teeth pattered onto the cockpit floor. There was a small thump as the Teflon disc, which had been in his knee, souvenir of a conflict marginally more honorable than the one in Northern Ireland, joined them. That was all. Nick Hopewell had ceased to exist. The first things Brian was aware of were that his shirt was wet and his headache had returned. He sat up slowly in his seat, wincing at the bolt of pain in his head, and tried to remember who he was, where he was, and why he felt such a vast and urgent need to wake up quickly. What had he been doing that was so important? The leak, his mind whispered. There's a leak in the main cabin, and if it isn't stabilized, there's going to be big tr... No, that wasn't right. The leak had been stabilized, or had in some mysterious way stabilized itself, and he had landed Flight 7 safely at LAX. Then the man in the green blazer had come, and... It's Anne's funeral. My God, I've overslept. His eyes flew open. But he was in neither a motel room nor the spare bedroom at Anne's brother's house in Revere. He was looking through a cockpit window at a sky filled with stars. Suddenly, it came back to him. Everything. He sat up all the way too quickly. His head screamed a sickly, hungover protest. Blood flew from his nose and splattered on the center control console. He looked down and saw that the front of his shirt was soaked with it. There had been a leak, all right, in him. Of course, he thought. Depressurization often does that. I should have warned the passengers. How many passengers do I have left, by the way? He couldn't remember. His head was filled with fog. He looked at his fuel indicators, saw that their situation was rapidly approaching the critical point, and then checked the INS. They were exactly where they should be, descending rapidly toward L.A., and at any moment they might wander into someone else's airspace while the someone else was still there. Someone else had been sharing his airspace just before he passed out. Who? He fumbled. And it came. Nick, of course. Nick Hopewell. Nick was gone. He hadn't been such a bad penny after all, it seemed. But he must have done his job, or Brian wouldn't be awake now. He got on the radio fast. LAX ground control, this is American Pride flight... He stopped. What flight were they? He couldn't remember. The fog was in the way.
29, aren't we?
A dazed, unsteady voice said from behind him. Thank you, Laurel. Brian didn't turn around. Now go back and belt up. I may have to make this plane do some tricks. He spoke into his mic again. American Pride, flight 29, repeat. 2-9er. Mayday, ground control.
I'm declaring an emergency here. Please clear everything in front of me. I'm coming in on heading 8-5, and I have no fuel. Get a foam truck out and...
Oh, quit it, Laurel said dully from behind him. Just quit it.
Brian wheeled around, ignoring the fresh bolt of pain through his head and the first spray of blood which flew from his nose.
Sit down, goddammit, he snarled. We're coming in unannounced into heavy traffic. If you don't want to break your neck...
There's no heavy traffic down there, Laurel said in the same dull voice. No heavy traffic, no foam trucks. Nick died for nothing, and I'll never get a chance to deliver his message. Look for yourself.
Brian did, and although they were now over the outlying suburbs of Los Angeles, he saw nothing but darkness. There was no one down there, it seemed. No one at all. Behind him, Laurel Stevenson burst into harsh, raging sobs of terror and frustration. A long white passenger jet cruised slowly above the ground 16 miles east of Los Angeles International Airport. 767 was printed on its tail in large, proud numerals. Along the fuselage, the words American Pride were written in letters which had been raked backward to indicate speed. On both sides of the nose was a large red eagle, its wings spangled with blue stars. Like the airliner it decorated, the eagle appeared to be coming in for a landing. The plane printed no shadow on the deserted grid of streets as it passed above them. Dawn was still an hour away. Below it, no car moved, no street light glowed. Below it, all was silent and moveless. Ahead of it, no runway lights gleamed. The plane's belly slid open. The undercarriage dropped down and spread out. The landing gear locked in place. American Pride Flight 29 slipped down the chute toward L.A. It banked slightly to the right as it came. Brian was now able to correct his course visually, and he did so. They passed over a cluster of airport motels, and for a moment Brian could see the monument that stood near the center of the terminal complex, a graceful tripod with curved legs and a restaurant in its center. They passed over a short strip of dead grass, and then concrete runway was unrolling 30 feet below the plane. There was no time to baby the 767 in this time. Brian's fuel indicators read zeros across, and the bird was about to turn into a bitch. He brought it in hard, like a sled filled with bricks. There was a thud that rattled his teeth and started his nose bleeding again. His chest harness locked. Laurel, who was in the co-pilot's seat, cried out. Then he had the flaps up and was applying reverse thrusters at full. The plane began to slow. They were doing a little over 100 miles an hour when two of the thrusters cut out and the red engine shutdown lights flashed on. He grabbed for the intercom switch. Hang on, we're going in hard. Hang on. Thrusters 2 and 4 kept running a few moments longer, and then they were gone too. Flight 29 rushed down the runway in ghastly silence, with only the flaps to slow her now. Brian watched helplessly as the concrete ran away beneath the plane and the crisscross tangle of taxiways loomed. And there, dead ahead, sat the carcass of a Pacific Airways commuter jet. The 767 was still doing at least 65. Brian hoisted to the right, leaning into the dead steering yoke with every ounce of his strength. The plane responded soupily, and he skated by the parked jet with only 6 feet to spare. Its windows flashed past like a row of blind eyes. Then they were rolling toward the United Terminal, where at least a dozen planes were parked at extended jetways like nursing infants. The 767 speed was down to just over 30 now.
Brace yourselves!
Brian shouted into the intercom, momentarily forgetting that his own plane was now as dead as the rest of them and the intercom was useless.
Brace yourselves for a collision! Brake!
American Pride 29 crashed into Gate 29 of United Airlines Terminal at roughly 29 miles an hour. There was a loud, hollow bang followed by the sound of crumpling metal and breaking glass. Brian was thrown into his harness again, then snapped back into his seat. He sat there for a moment, stiff, waiting for the explosion, and then remembered there was nothing left in the tanks to explode. He flicked all the switches on the control panel off. The panel was dead, but the habit ran deep, and then turned to check on Laurel. She looked at him with dull, apathetic eyes.
That was about as close as I ever want to cut it, Brian said unsteadily.
You should have let us crash. Everything we tried. Dinah, Nick, all for nothing. It's just the same here, just the same.
Brian unbuckled his harness and got shakily to his feet. He took his handkerchief out of his back pocket and handed it to her. Wipe your nose. It's bleeding. She took the handkerchief and then only looked at it, as if she had never seen one before in her life. Brian passed her and plodded slowly into the main cabin. He stood in the doorway, counting noses. His passengers, those few still remaining, that was, seemed all right. Bethany's head was pressed against Albert's chest, and she was sobbing hard. Rudy Warwick unbuckled his seatbelt, got up, wrapped his head on the overhead bin, and sat down again. He looked at Brian with dazed, uncomprehending eyes. Brian found himself wondering if Rudy was still hungry. He guessed not. "Let's get off the plane," Brian said. Bethany raised her head.
"When do they come?" she asked him hysterically. "How long will it be before they come this time? Can anyone hear them yet?"
Fresh pain struck Brian's head and he rocked on his feet, suddenly quite sure he was going to faint. A steadying arm slipped around his waist and he looked around, surprised. It was Laurel. "Captain Engel's right," she said quietly. "Let's get off the plane. Maybe it's not as bad as it looks." Bethany uttered a hysterical bark of laughter.
"How bad can it look?" she demanded. "Just how bad can it?"
"Something's different," Albert said suddenly. He was looking out the window. "Something's changed. I can't tell what it is, but it's not the same." He looked first at Bethany, then at Brian and Laurel. "It's just not the same." Brian bent down next to Bob Jenkins and looked out the window. He could see nothing very different from BIA. There were more planes, of course, but they were just as deserted, just as dead. Yet he felt that Albert might be onto something just the same. It was feeling more than seeing. Some essential difference which he could not quite grasp. It danced just beyond his reach, as the name of his ex-wife's perfume had done. "It's L'Envoi, darling. It's what I've always worn. Don't you remember? Don't you remember?" "Come on," he said. "This time we use the cockpit exit." Brian opened the trap door, which lay below the jut of the instrument panel, and tried to remember why he hadn't used it to offload his passengers at Bangor International. It was a hell of a lot easier to use than the slide. There didn't seem to be a why. He just hadn't thought of it. Probably because he was trained to think of the escape slide before anything else in an emergency. He dropped down into the forward hold area, ducked below a cluster of electrical cables, and undogged the hatch in the floor of the 767's nose. Albert joined him and helped Bethany down. Brian helped Laurel. Then he and Albert helped Rudy, who moved as if his bones had turned to glass. Rudy was still clutching his rosary tight in one hand. The space below the cockpit was now very cramped, and Bob Jenkins waited for them above, propped on his hands and peering down at them through the trap door. Brian pulled the ladder out of its storage clips, secured it in place, and then one by one, they descended to the tarmac. Brian first, Bob last. As Brian's feet touched down, he felt a mad urge to place his hand over his heart and cry out, "I claim this land of rancid milk and sour honey for the survivors of Flight 29. At least until the Langoliers arrive." He said nothing. He only stood there with the others below the loom of the jetliner's nose, feeling a light breeze against one cheek and looking around. In the distance, he heard a sound. It was not the chewing, crunching sound of which they had gradually become aware in Bangor. Nothing like it. But he couldn't decide exactly what it did sound like.
"What's that?" Bethany asked. "What's that humming? It sounds like electricity."
"No, it doesn't," Bob said thoughtfully. "It sounds like..." He shook his head. "It doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard before," Brian said. But he wasn't sure if that was true. Again, he was haunted by the sense that something he knew, or should know, was dancing just beyond his mental grasp.
"It's them, isn't it?"
Bethany asked half hysterically.
"It's them coming. It's the Langoliers Dinah told us about."
"I don't think so. It doesn't sound the same at all." But he felt the fear begin in his belly just the same.
"Now what?"
Rudy asked. His voice was as harsh as a crow's.
"Do we start all over again?"
"Well, we won't need the conveyor belt, and that's a start," Brian said. "The jetway service door is open." He stepped out from beneath the 767's nose and pointed. The force of their arrival at Gate 29 had knocked the rolling ladder away from the door, but it would be easy enough to slip it back into position. "Come on."
They walked toward the ladder. Albert, Brian said. Help me with the
Wait, Bob said.
Brian turned his head and saw Bob looking around with cautious wonder. And the expression in his previously dazed eyes, was that hope? What? What is it, Bob? What do you see?
Just another deserted airport. It's what I feel.
He raised a hand to his cheek, then simply held it out in the air like a man trying to flag a ride. Brian started to ask him what he meant and realized that he knew. Hadn't he noticed it himself while they had been standing under the liner's nose? Noticed it and then dismissed it? There was a breeze blowing against his face. Not much of a breeze, hardly more than a puff, but it was a breeze. The air was in motion.
Holy crow, Albert said.
He popped a finger into his mouth, wetting it, and held it up. An unbelieving grin touched his face. That isn't all either, Laurel said. Listen. She dashed from where they were standing down toward the 767's wing. Then she ran back to them again, her hair streaming out behind her. The high heels she was wearing clicked crisply on the concrete.
Did you hear it? She asked them. Did you hear it?
They had heard. The flat, muffled quality was gone. Now, just listening to Laurel speak, Brian realized that in Bangor, they had all sounded as if they had been talking with their heads poked inside bells which had been cast from some dulling metal, brass, or maybe lead. Bethany raised her hands and rapidly clapped out the backbeat of the old router's instrumental. Let's go. Each clap was as clean and clear as the pop of a track starter's pistol. A delighted grin broke over her face.
What does it mean? Rudy began.
The plane!
Albert shouted in a high-pitched, gleeful voice, and for a moment Brian was absurdly reminded of the little guy on that old TV show, Fantasy Island. He almost laughed out loud.
I know what's different. Look at the plane. Now it's the same as all the others.
They turned and looked. No one said anything for a long moment. Perhaps no one was capable of speech. The Delta 727, standing next to the American Pride jetliner in Bangor, had looked dull and dingy, somehow less real than the 767. Now all the aircraft, Flight 29 and the United Planes lined up along the extended jetways behind it, looked equally bright, equally new. Even in the dark, their paintwork and trademark logos appeared to gleam.
What does it mean? Rudy asked, speaking to Bob. What does it mean? If things have really gone back to normal, where's the electricity? Where are the people?
And what's that noise? Albert put in. The sound was already closer, already clearer. It was a humming sound, as Bethany had said, but there was nothing electrical about it. It sounded like wind blowing across an open pipe, or an inhuman choir which was uttering the same open-throated syllable in unison. Bob shook his head.
I don't know, he said, turning away. Let's push that ladder back into position and go in.
Laurel grabbed his shoulder.
You know something, she said. Her voice was strained and tense. I can see that you do. Let the rest of us in on it, why don't you?
He hesitated for a moment before shaking his head.
I'm not prepared to say right now, Laurel. I want to go inside and look around first.
With that, they had to be content. Brian and Albert pushed the ladder back into position. One of the supporting struts had buckled slightly, and Brian held it as they ascended one by one. He himself came last, walking on the side of the ladder away from the buckled strut. The others had waited for him, and they walked up the jetway and into the terminal together. They found themselves in a large round room with boarding gates located at intervals along the single curving wall. The rows of seats stood ghostly and deserted. The overhead fluorescents were dark squares. But here Albert thought he could almost smell other people, as if they had all trooped out only seconds before the Flight 29 survivors emerged from the jetway. From outside, that choral humming continued to swell, approaching like a slow, invisible wave. Come with me, Bob Jenkins said, taking effortless charge of the group. Quickly, please. He set off toward the concourse, and the others fell into line behind him, Albert and Bethany walking together with arms linked about each other's waists. Once off the carpeted surface of the United boarding lounge and in the concourse itself, their heels clicked and echoed as if there were 24 of them instead of only 6. They passed dim, dark advertising posters on the walls. Watch CNN, smoke Marlboros, drive Hertz, read Newsweek, see Disneyland. And that sound, that open-throated choral humming sound, continued to grow. Outside, Laurel had been convinced the sound had been approaching them from the west. Now it seemed to be right in here with them, as though the singers, if they were singers, had already arrived. The sound did not frighten her exactly, but it made the flesh of her arms and back prickle with awe. They reached a cafeteria-style restaurant, and Bob led them inside. Without pausing, he went around the counter and took a wrapped pastry from a pile of them on the counter. He tried to tear it open with his teeth, then realized his teeth were back on the plane. He made a small, disgusted sound and tossed it over the counter to Albert. "You do it," he said. His eyes were glowing now. "Quickly, Albert, quickly!" "Quick, Watson, the game's afoot," Albert said and laughed crazily. He tore open the cellophane and looked at Bob, who nodded. Albert took out the pastry and bit into it. Cream and raspberry jam squirted out the sides. Albert grinned.
"It's delicious," he said in a muffled voice, spraying crumbs as he spoke. "Delicious!"
He offered it to Bethany, who took an even larger bite. Laurel could smell the raspberry filling, and her stomach made a goinging, boinging sound. She laughed. Suddenly she felt giddy, joyful, almost stoned. The cobwebs from the depressurization experience were entirely gone. Her head felt like an upstairs room after a fresh sea breeze had blown in on a hot and horribly muggy afternoon. She thought of Nick, who wasn't here, who had died so the rest of them could be here, and thought that Nick would not have minded her feeling this way. The choral sound continued to swell, a sound with no direction at all, a sourceless, singing sigh that existed all around them. Bob Jenkins raced back around the counter, cutting the corner by the cash register so tightly that his feet almost flew out from beneath him, and he had to grab the condiments trolley to keep from falling. He stayed up, but the stainless steel trolley fell over with a gorgeous, resounding crash, spraying plastic cutlery and little packets of mustard, ketchup, and relish everywhere. "Quickly," he cried. "We can't be here. It's going to happen soon, at any moment, I believe. And we can't be here when it does. I don't think it's safe."
"What isn't?"
Bethany began. But then Albert put his arm around her shoulders and hustled her after Bob, a lunatic tour guide who had already bolted for the cafeteria door. They ran out, following him as he dashed for the United boarding lobby again. Now the echoing rattle of their footfalls was almost lost in the powerful hum which filled the deserted terminal, echoing and re-echoing in the many throats of its spoked corridors. Brian could hear that single vast note beginning to break up. It was not shattering, not even really changing, he thought, but focusing, the way the sound of the Langoliers had focused as they approached Bangor. As they re-entered the boarding lounge, he saw an ethereal light begin to skate over the empty chairs, the dark arrivals and departures TV monitors, and the boarding desks. Red followed blue, yellow followed red, green followed yellow. Some rich and exotic expectation seemed to fill the air. A shiver chased through him. He felt all his body hair stir and try to stand up. A clear assurance filled him like a morning sun ray. We are on the verge of something. Some great and amazing thing.
"Over here!"
Bob shouted. He led them toward the wall beside the jetway through which they had entered. This was a passengers-only area guarded by a red velvet rope. Bob jumped it as easily as the high school hurdler he might once have been.
"Against the wall!"
"Up against the wall, motherfuckers!" Albert cried through a spasm of sudden, uncontrollable laughter.
He and the rest joined Bob, pressing against the wall like suspects in a police lineup. In the deserted circular lounge, which now lay before them, the colors flared for a moment, then began to fade out. The sound, however, continued to deepen and become more real. Brian thought he could now hear voices in that sound, and footsteps, even a few fussing babies.
"I don't know what it is, but it's wonderful," Laurel cried. She was half laughing, half weeping. "I love it!
I hope we're safe here,"
Bob said. He had to raise his voice to be heard.
"I think we will be. We're out of the main traffic areas."
"What's going to happen?" Brian asked. "What do you know?"
"When we went through the time rip headed east, we traveled back in time," Bob shouted. "We went into the past! Perhaps as little as 15 minutes. Do you remember me telling you that?"
Brian nodded, and Albert's face suddenly lit up. "This time it brought us into the future," Albert cried. "That's it, isn't it? This time the rip brought us into the future." "I believe so, yes," Bob yelled back. He was grinning helplessly. "And instead of arriving in a dead world, a world which had moved on without us, we have arrived in a world waiting to be born. A world as fresh and new as a rose on the verge of opening. That is what's happening now, I believe. That is what we hear and what we sense, what has filled us with such marvelous, helpless joy. I believe we are about to see and experience something which no living man or woman has ever witnessed before. We have seen the death of the world. Now I believe we are going to see it born. I believe that the present is on the verge of catching up to us."
As the colors had flared and faded, so now the deep, reverberating quality of the sound suddenly dropped. At the same time, the voices which had been within it grew louder, clearer. Laurel realized she could make out words, even whole phrases.
"Have to call her before she decides."
"I really don't think the option is a viable..."
"Home and dry if we can just turn this thing over to the parent company."
That one passed directly before them through the emptiness on the other side of the velvet rope. Brian Engel felt a kind of ecstasy rise within him, suffusing him in a glow of wonder and happiness. He took Laurel's hand and grinned at her as she clasped it, and then squeezed it fiercely. Beside them, Albert suddenly hugged Bethany, and she began to shower kisses all over his face, laughing as she did it. Bob and Rudy grinned at each other delightedly, like long-lost friends who have met by chance in one of the world's most absurd backwaters. Overhead, the fluorescent squares in the ceiling began to flash on. They went sequentially, racing out from the center of the room in an expanding circle of light that flowed down the concourse, chasing the night shadows before it like a flock of black sheep. Smells suddenly struck Brian with a bang. Sweat, perfume, aftershave, cologne, cigarette smoke, leather, soap, industrial cleaner. For a moment longer, the wide circle of the boarding lounge remained deserted, a place haunted by the voices and footsteps of the not-quite-living. And Brian thought, "I am going to see it happen. I am going to see the moving present lock onto this stationary future and pull it along, the way hooks on moving express trains used to snatch bags of mail from the postal service poles standing by the tracks in sleepy little towns down south and out west. I am going to see time itself open like a rose on a summer morning."
"Brace yourselves," Bob murmured. "There may be a jerk."
A bare second later, Brian felt a thud, not just in his feet, but all through his body. At the same instant, he felt as if an invisible hand had given him a strong push directly in the center of his back. He rocked forward and felt Laurel rock forward with him. Albert had to grab Rudy to keep him from falling over. Rudy didn't seem to mind. A huge, goony smile split his face.
"Look!"
Laurel gasped.
"Oh, Brian, look!"
He looked and felt his breath stop in his throat. The boarding lounge was full of ghosts. Ethereal, transparent figures crossed and crisscrossed the large central area. Men in business suits toting briefcases, women in smart traveling dresses, teenagers in Levi's and T-shirts with rock group logos printed on them. He saw a ghost father leading two small ghost children, and through them he could see more ghosts sitting in the chairs, reading transparent copies of Cosmopolitan and Esquire and U.S. News and World Report. Then color dove into the shapes in a series of cometary flickers, solidifying them, and the echoing voices resolved themselves into the prosaic stereo swarm of real human voices. Shooting stars, Brian thought wonderingly. Shooting stars only. The two children were the only ones who happened to be looking directly at the survivors of Flight 29 when the change took place. The children were the only ones who saw four men and two women appear in a place where there had only been a wall the second before.
"Daddy!"
the little boy exclaimed, tugging his father's right hand.
"Dad!"
the little girl demanded, tugging his left.
"What?"
he asked, tossing them an impatient glance.
"I'm looking for your mother."
"No people,"
the little girl said, pointing at Brian and his bedraggled quintet of passengers.
"Look at the new people."
The man glanced at Brian and the others for a moment, and his mouth tightened nervously. It was the blood, Brian supposed.
He, Laurel, and Bethany had all suffered nosebleeds. The man tightened his grip on their hands and began to pull them away fast.
Yes, great. Now help me look for your mother. What a mess this turned out to be.
But they weren't there before,
the little boy protested. They... Then they were gone into the hurrying crowds. Brian glanced up at the monitors and noted the time as 4:17 a.m. Too many people here, he thought, and I bet I know why. As if to confirm this, the overhead speaker blared, "All eastbound flights out of Los Angeles International Airport continue to be delayed because of unusual weather patterns over the Mojave Desert. We are sorry for this inconvenience, but ask for your patience and understanding while this safety precaution is in force. Repeat, all eastbound flights..."
Unusual weather patterns, Brian thought. Oh, yeah. Strangest goddamn weather patterns ever.
Laurel turned to Brian and looked up into his face. Tears streamed down her cheeks, and she made no effort to wipe them away.
"Did you hear her? Did you hear what that little girl said?"
"Yes."
"Is that what we are, Brian? The new people? Do you think that's what we are?"
"I don't know," he said, "but that's what it feels like."
"That was wonderful,"
Albert said.
"My God, that was the most wonderful thing."
"Totally tubular,"
Bethany yelled happily, and then began to clap out, "Let's go," again. "What do we do now, Brian?" Bob asked. "Any ideas?" Brian glanced around at the choked boarding area and said, "I think I want to go outside, breathe some fresh air, and look at the sky."
"Shouldn't we inform the authorities of what..."
"We will," Brian said, "but the sky first."
"And maybe something to eat on the way?"
Rudy asked hopefully. Brian laughed.
"Why not?" "My watch has stopped," Bethany said.
Brian looked down at his wrist and saw that his watch had also stopped. All their watches had stopped. Brian took his off, dropped it indifferently to the floor, and put his arm around Laurel's waist. "Let's blow this joint," he said. "Unless any of you want to wait for the next flight east."
"Not today," Laurel said. "But soon. All the way to England. There's a man I have to see, and..."
For one horrible moment, the name wouldn't come to her. And then it did.
"Fluting," she said. "Ask anyone along the high street. The old folks still just call him the gaffer."
"What are you talking about?" Albert asked.
"Daisies," she said and laughed. "I'm talking about daisies. Come on, let's go."
Bob grinned widely, exposing baby pink gums. "As for me, I think that the next time I have to go to Boston, I'll take the train." Laurel towed Brian's watch and asked, "Are you sure you don't want that? It looks expensive." Brian grinned, shook his head, and kissed her forehead. The smell of her hair was amazingly sweet. He felt more than good. He felt reborn. Every inch of him new and fresh and unmarked by the world. He felt, in fact, that if he spread his arms, he would be able to fly without the aid of engines. "Not at all," he said. "I know what time it is."
"Oh, and what time is that?"
"It's 9:30 now." Albert clapped him on the back. They left the boarding lounge in a group, weaving their way through the disgruntled clots of delayed passengers. A good many of these looked curiously after them, and not just because some of them appeared to have recently suffered nosebleeds, or because they were laughing their way through so many angry, inconvenienced people. They looked because the six people seemed somehow brighter than anyone else in the crowded lounge. More actual. More there. Shooting stars only, Brian thought, and suddenly remembered that there was one passenger still back on the plane. The man with the black beard. This is one hangover that guy will never forget, Brian thought, grinning. He swept Laurel into a run. She laughed and hugged him. The six of them ran down the concourse together toward the escalators and all the outside world beyond.